You loved it in the theater or heard about it in the media. Facing the Giants, the film that inspired millions of moviegoers to never give up and never back down.
We need to give God our best in every area. And if we win, we praise Him. And if we lose, we praise Him.
And never lose faith.
For the rest of your life, you will remember today. I want you to remember that you held nothing back. You did not lose heart. You did not stop fighting. You did not quit.
Experience this incredible movie all over again. Or for the first time. And believe.
I can't believe what I just seen. I cannot believe what I just seen.
Now you can see this remarkable movie at a special showing in your city. Here's the announcer with details.
Come to Maranatha Christian Center Friday, March 16th for a 7 p.m. showtime for Facing the Giants. There's no admission charge, so we'll see you at Maranatha in Arvada at 72nd and Oak, March 16th at 7 p.m. Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, pastor of Denver Bible Church, and welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday with our friend Fred Williams. Fred, welcome to Bob Enyart Live.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be back.
Fred, you're a software engineer.
That's right, and also I've been speaking on creation for a little over 10 years now.
10 years, so anybody in the Colorado area that has a school, a church, they'd like a presentation with slides. You do a great job. You've done your presentation at Maranatha, right?
That's right.
Maranatha Christian Center. And Fred is also the webmaster for the Creation Research Society. They're one of the big three creation groups. But today, we're concluding our look at a journal from another organization, Creation Ministries International. And they're great, too, aren't they?
Oh, they're wonderful. They're a spinoff, actually, recently from AIG. They're based
Answers
in Australia.
Genesis, right?
Yes.
They're in Australia, and they have a fabulous publication, Journal of Creation. Later in the program, we'll tell you how you could get a free subscription to this Journal of Creation. But first, in the last program, Fred, you started to introduce a book written by Hugh Ross. Now, he's a creationist of sorts, right?
Yeah, he's what he terms it, progressive creationist. And they believe in millions of years. They believe in the Big Bang. They believe hominids were created by God and all these animals over millions of years. And then along came Adam and Eve and God created them. So he doesn't accept that evolution created all life.
Right.
He doesn't believe that we share a common ancestor with the apes.
They believe that God did not create in a brief time and then the natural law took over. They believe God intervened hundreds, if not thousands of times to keep recreating. And so that's not the story of the Bible, but that's their view. So Hugh Ross co-authored a book with a Faisal Rana.
Yeah, it's Who Was Adam?
Who Was Adam? Part of this Journal of Creation, there's a section of book reviews. It's so great. I read these, and I've just got an overview of five books.
This is a great critique of Hugh Ross's theology and science. Mm-hmm. You know, Hugh Ross believes in millions and millions of years of death, disease, and suffering.
Right.
And this all is in contradiction to the Bible and the teachings in Genesis. So it's a direct assault on Genesis, even though he tries to appease Christians to some extent, but he's still taking a big shot at Genesis by accepting the millions of years of death and disease
and
the Big Bang and things like
well,
that.
Well, one of the first things in this review is the reviewer says, hey, Hugh Ross is criticizing the teaching of creation in the science classroom in his book. Hugh Ross is agreeing with some anti-creationists who say that creation should not be taught alongside evolution in the classroom. And Hugh Ross in his book, he's agreeing with them. He's not complaining to the teaching of evolution in the classroom, but just creation. So right off the bat, it's peculiar.
That was really strange because as someone who claims that they don't believe in evolution, why would you want it taught to our kids and not counter arguments to evolution?
Hugh Ross, with the progressive creationists in this country, they believe that God spent millions of years creating these hominids, all these ape-like creatures, monkey-like, chimp-like creatures. And then eventually, after millions of years of working with apes, God then got it right, I guess, and then he made human beings.
Yeah, he got tired of monkeying around, I guess.
Yeah. Now, they wouldn't say that God then got it right, but after millions of years of making all different species, including dinosaurs and all, then God made human beings. He made them male and female. Okay, so the reviewer of this article says, okay, that's what Hugh Ross teaches, but Jesus Christ said at Mark 10, verse 6, Jesus Christ emphatically said that, quote, at the beginning of creation, God made them male and female.
That's right. Jesus ties together Genesis 1 and 2. How can you get millions of years in there? It says, in the beginning, Christ made them male and female. It didn't say, after millions of years, then in the beginning, he made them male and female.
Yeah, at the beginning of creation. And when the Bible says in the beginning, that's what it means. It means in the beginning of the creation, God made. And then God, for 6 days, he labored. On the seventh day, he rested. He ceased from his labor. And the Ten Commandments quotes that and says, in 6 days, the Lord made the heavens, the earth, the seas, and everything in them, rested on the seventh. And that's the model for our week, our work
exactly.
week. 6 days you labor, and the seventh day you rest.
Now, Jesus appeals to Genesis more than any other book in the Bible, and when he appeals to it, he's always appealing to it as real history and not as some parable.
Yeah, and so this reviewer also points out that in the Hugh Ross argument that the earth existed for millions of years before Adam and Eve, there was tremendous disease and violence and death before the creation of Adam and Eve. Yet after God made man, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 31, God saw all that he had made, and it was very good.
That's right. It was a paradise, and it was man's sin that brought death into the world. There wasn't millions of years of death, disease, and suffering. In fact, death is an enemy to God. It says that, I believe, in 1 Corinthians 14. Death is an enemy. What's the shortest verse in the Bible?
Jesus wept.
Well, why did he weep? You know, it had to be, Lazarus. He was over the case of Lazarus, but he knows he's God. He can raise him from the dead. I submit he wept because death
is
an enemy to God, and it causes him pain. I mean, you know, it's us humans brought death into the world.
God grieves over our sin and death. In the Bible, some people say God ordains everything, including a child who's raped, and because he ordains things for his glory and his pleasure. But God says, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked.
That's right. And what is God going to do with death? He's going to do away with death, as it says in Revelation. It's an enemy that God will do away with. So death is a temporary part of history in the biblical worldview. But in a secular worldview, which Hugh Ross has embraced for the most part, death is a permanent part of history.
Mm-hmm. And we're not saying that single-celled organisms, bacteria, plants, Adam and Eve would have eaten plants. They could have cooked them and destroyed them for their own use. And that's fine. We're talking about creatures with a soul. They didn't die.
Exactly.
Right. Okay, very good. So in this book, this cracks me up. I've read Hugh Ross in the past. I think he has one of his titles, The Finger of God. And reading it, I get so frustrated because it's so illogical. Now, he's a scientist, but this is an example. In this book, he lists 13 predictions of his human origins model. And when I read about predictions, like in Walt Brown's book in the beginning, he has predictions that are really predictions. And I have a hard time calling these predictions.
They're not. They're things that were already known about, and then he claims that they're a prediction.
Yeah, like humanity began in or near the Middle East. Now, he says that because of the out of Africa model that the evolutionists say human beings started in Africa. So he says, okay, the Bible says that in or near the Middle East, that's where humanity started. And I don't know, Africa is not in the Middle East. But anyway, okay, then he says that mankind would spread around the world. That's prediction number 12. I mean, come on, what kind of a prediction is that? Even evolutionists believe that mankind evolved somewhere and then spread around the world. What kind of a prediction is that? It's too weird, Fred. And then prediction number 2, humanity's early population was relatively small.
Well, there's a shocker.
I just can't, I don't know if we should be making fun of this, but this is too goofy. It's goofy, and he is respected as the head of a valid alternate movement to young earth creationism, and there is no other opposition to young earth creationism that is valid from the biblical perspective. This stuff is silly. His prediction number 10, this has got to be, the author of this review calls this an exquisite oxymoron. His prediction number 10.
A universal but local flood that impacted all of humanity shaped human history.
A universal but local flood. What does that mean? That's an exquisite oxymoron. You know, that's a big division between creationists, those who are progressive creationists, they accept the Big Bang and all that. They're against the global flood.
That's right, because it would have tore apart their beloved geologic column that they so believe in.
Yeah, they believe the geologic column, this stuff was laid down over billions of years, but we know the stuff was laid down rapidly.
That's right.
Like a million years of strata in the Midwest laid down over a million years, seven layers of strata, and then they find jellyfish fossils through all seven layers. So, okay, those jellyfish were not hanging around in that one lagoon for a million years.
And then theologically, the problems are enormous to try to get a local flood out of what the Bible teaches. The Bible is real clear on a global flood.
Right.
And I feel sorry for those people that are in local floods and they see a rainbow and they say, wait a minute, God, didn't you say the rainbow was a promise that you wouldn't send another flood? But if they're all, was local, then why are there still rainbows after local floods?
Like New Orleans being destroyed by those floodwaters. And yet God promised he would never again send a global flood.
That's right.
And so for Hugh Ross, and he knows that's the big division between the old earth creationist and the young earth, is the young earth believes in a universal flood. So his prediction number 10 is that there would be a universal but local flood impacting all of humanity, shaping human history. Now, the flood has impacted all of humanity because anthropologists have documented 100 flood stories, accounts from cultures all over the world.
That's right.
Of this flood that destroyed mankind, the animals, some survived in a dish, a bowl, whatever. And so, yeah, there was a flood that's affected the history of the human race, our collective memory. So anyway, these are weird things. And, you know, Walt Brown, he makes predictions in his book. In the beginning, he predicted things like when we look at comets close up, we'll find minerals from the Earth in the comets. And NASA's done that, and that prediction was right on. He's predicted that in the trenches in the Pacific, they're so deep we can't get down there to study them like we want to. But he's predicted that there is no subduction going on. There's no plate tectonics. When we get down there, the sediments in those trenches will be settled. They will not be disturbed as if subduction was happening. They'd be beautifully settled. And so those are predictions.
Yeah, those are real scientific predictions. It reminds me of Dr. Russ Humphreys made predictions on the magnetic field strength of planets and moons. And this is before the Voyager was able to take these measurements. This is back, I think, in 1984. Well, in 1988, they made the measurements, and they were within like a percent of what Humphreys predicted based on his creation biblical worldview model of what he'd expected the magnetic field strengths to be. It totally contradicted what the secular magnetic field strength, what they believed it would be, because they, you know, their paradigm of the Big Bang and billions of years and how things form.
So these are real predictions, and CRS, Creation Research Society Quarterly, published predictions of how many helium atoms we find in zircon crystals, because helium atoms have a way of getting out of things because they're so tiny.
The prediction was of how rapidly it would diffuse out of the rock if the rock was 6,000 years old. How rapidly would it diffuse out of the rock if it was a billion years old? They published it in a book called
They published the charts.
Then they did the experiment.
They sent the zircon crystals to a high-precision laboratory in Montreal or something.
Yeah, and it was not a laboratory favorable to creationists. So
no,
what they did was they sent it through a mining company, so they didn't know it was coming from creationists. So they did the study. And the data came back, and it all lined up on the 6,000-year-old chart.
Beautiful.
It was awesome. It's one of the best arguments we have right now for a young Earth. And Russell Humphreys said that evolutionists have a real burden explaining how, by sheer coincidence and chance, this data just happened to perfectly line up on the 6,000-year chart.
And if that rock had been a billion years old, then the data was off by a factor of 10,000 or something.
Oh, exactly.
And so there is so much evidence. When you have a piece of truth, no matter which way you look at it, it will be reinforced. That's generally how we understand. How do you know cops, when they're investigating a murder, how do they know when they're zeroing in on the right suspect because everything points to him. When they got somebody and they got to squeeze it, it might be the wrong guy. But then they find the right guy and everything fits.
That's right.
That's pretty cool. Okay, so his book, Who Was Adam? He goes through the whole list of brain sizes, like Australopithecus had tiny brain size, got bigger in Homo habilis, bigger in Homo erectus. Then they mentioned Neanderthal. And the problem is, this reviewer points out, for one, does bigger brains, does that indicate smarter people, more intelligence?
No, it doesn't. In fact, we talked about that on the last show.
Yeah, right.
You gave the great analogy of the Japanese student compared to the jocks. Big
in a
football
physics
or basketball.
Class, the Japanese students are all going to get A's, and quite often the jocks, they'll drop the class because they'll say, this professor grades on a curve, and there's 12 Japanese students in here, and there's no way I'm getting an A, I'm dropping. And his brain, his cranial capacity is double this 19-year-old, young, small Japanese girl. Double, but he's not twice as smart. And so it's so juvenile for the evolutionists to say, look at the brain sizes. They're getting bigger, they're getting smarter.
Well, not only that, he picks and chooses because the range of brain size, it really is wide, and he picks ones that fit his paradigm.
Right. This reviewer says the human brain size range is it goes from a smallest to about triple the size of the smallest, from 790 cubic centimeters to 2,200. So like 800 to 2,200 cubic centimeters. That's almost triple as large, and there's no correlation between brain size and intelligence. So he says, well, Neanderthal, you know, their brain size, they got bigger. Why? Because a bigger body needed a bigger brain to control its limbs? That's too goofy.
Oh, yeah. And then he makes wild speculations, like you said, that the Neanderthals lacked the necessary brain structure to think and act in a way that reflects God's image. But as we talked before the show, Bob, about Neanderthals having tools, they buried their dead.
Right.
So they were a very cultured society, and to say that they didn't think and act in a way that reflects God's image.
Yes, Neanderthals, now, they're humans. Creationists say they're humans. Hugh Ross wants them to be monkeys.
That's right.
Because he likes to reinforce the evolutionary timescale. And so even though this is used by millions of people to reject Jesus Christ, he likes it. So he wants to turn humans into monkeys and monkeys into humans. That's would be his inclination. And Neanderthals, the evolutionists don't deny, they buried their dead.
Many evolutionists actually classify Neanderthal as Homo sapien.
Yeah, because their practices, I mean, you bury your dead. They made tools. We have tools that they made have survived. And it appears there's evidence that they made a flute and out of bone, and in fact, the scale is similar to our do-re-mi scale, only there's just four holes in this flute, and some evolutionists say, oh, that's not true, that was just a happenstance.
An animal chewed on that bone. It's silly, right? Because holes are real circular.
And Hugh Ross wants Neanderthal to be a monkey, and he makes this extraordinary claim that they could not have been made in God's image. And why? What's the point? Now, in his chapter on Neanderthals, he and his co-author, they flaunt the study on the dental growth of Neanderthals. And by the way, I'm not saying the TH. In America, we say Neanderthal. In Europe and Australia, they say Neanderthal. So a lot of the journals I read say Neanderthal. So that's how I've come to pronounce it. But in his chapter on Neanderthals, he quotes from this study how Neanderthal dental growth, right, that the growth rate of their teeth, they matured way more rapidly than humans. And they say, see that? That shows that Neanderthals were not human. And so the very next part of the review, the same paragraph, says, however, more recent research has indicated, and that happens all the time, the knee-jerk reaction of the Big Bang, the evolutionary age scientist, gets corrected over and again. Moreover, recent research has indicated this study to be flawed, with the new evidence being that Neanderthal tooth growth and, by extension, somatic growth appears to be encompassed within the modern human range of an interpopulation variation. Now, you know what? Was that published by a creationist? No, that study was published by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which is total evolutionary, bastion. And so over and over and again, people say, oh, look at this. This proves the Big Bang. Turns out, no, it doesn't. This proves evolution. No, it doesn't.
Yep. Constantly there's God thwarting a naturalistic explanation of these things.
Yeah. It really is enjoyable. So that's Hugh Ross pretty much. At the very end of his book, he has a chapter on junk DNA, which this reviewer says actually is good, because Hugh Ross does say that God created us. And so he stands with us on a number of the arguments against the evolutionists. But what's the whole junk DNA argument that supposedly proves evolution?
It's somehow that it's leftover junk over time that evolution discards. And so that's why we have so-called junk DNA. But over time, we continually find function in the so-called junk DNA that many geneticists realize that it's not junk at all. It serves a function, regulating proteins, things like that. In fact, they found
immune system.
That's right. And they found examples of mutations or changes in them that cause disease. So if you've got a change in something that's junk and it's causing a disease, that's proof right there that it's not junk.
That's what began them to take this closer look at junk DNA. We're just beginning, even now, we're just beginning to understand genetics, even now. And so they say, okay, these amino acids here, this part of the chain of the DNA double helix, this codes for a protein. So we know that's useful, and it makes a protein, a little machine to help your body function. This other chunk, it's all messed up. It doesn't make a protein. It's just junk. So they said, okay, a lot of our DNA is junk. Hundreds of millions of pairs of amino acids are just junk. And then they find a disease, and where the people have that disease have something broke in the junk. And they
exactly.
say, now, wait a minute, if the junk is broke and you get this disease, that must not be junk. So they, as they begin to look at it, wherever they've been looking at junk DNA, they find function.
That's right.
They find function. You remember Eugenie Scott, Dr. Eugenie Scott?
Oh, yeah. You had a show with her where you debated her and questioned her on this whole issue of junk DNA.
Years ago. Actually, it's called Bob Debates an Evolutionist. She's a physical anthropologist. She is a full-time anti-creationist. That's what she does.
That's her job, basically.
That's her job. She's on PBS nationwide, Creation is False. So I said, Eugenie, we have an hour. Give me three pieces of evidence that higher functions in organisms evolved, like eyesight or locomotion or whatever, radar location. Just give me three pieces of evidence that these higher functions actually evolved so the audience can know what you're basing your belief on. And she got angry at me that I asked for evidence, and she said, that's a sign of a religious fanatic.
That's right.
That's in the debate.
Yep.
That's in the debate. And so then I kept pressing her.
Plus her musings constantly about her cat.
Her cat. And she was saying, well, I don't debate. And a couple weeks later, she was on a national debate on TV. And so by the end of our hour on Bob and Your Live, she said, well, I don't debate. But anyway, I said, Eugenie, so far you haven't given us any evidence that shows that these higher functions evolved. And she said, junk DNA. I said, all right, explain what you mean. Junk DNA is proof that God didn't create us, because if we had a creator, we wouldn't have all this junk in our DNA. I said, Eugenie, we are just at the beginning of our understanding. This is going on 10 years ago. We're just at the beginning of our understanding of DNA and genetics and genes and the genome. And she said, that's not true. We basically understand how genetics function. We have the big picture. I said, Eugenie, let me give you a chance to take that back. Why don't you take that back? Because that's going to sound really ignorant in 20 years, Eugenie Scott says, because I'm writing down the date and the time. And
it really only took about 4 or 5 years for that to really sound ignorant.
Yeah, so the only evidence she could come up with in an hour debate was junk DNA, and it turns out that junk is not junk. It's vital for healthy organisms.
That's right.
Okay, so that's Hugh Ross's book. There's another one called The White Australia Policy. And the only thing about this guy, he is not a creationist, but he is tracking Australia's policies toward non-whites in history. And he says Darwin's beliefs and those of Darwin's followers like Ernest Haeckel led directly to racism and the acceptance of racist behavior. And, Fred, creationists have been arguing that for years.
Oh, that's right, that Darwin himself was a racist. If you look at the title of his book, The Origin of Species of Favored Races,
yeah,
most evolutionists who are informed know that he was a racist. And evolution, among many of its fruits, is racism. We've been saying that for years. And here this guy is a secular author, and he's documenting the connection between racism in Australia and evolution.
And he also points out that as Darwinism came in, that was attack on Christian morality.
That's right.
An evolutionist would deny that until you come to today, where they throw morality right out the window. Forget about sexual morality. If it feels good, do it. And that, of course, destroys people by the millions. Then there's this next book, The Victory of Reason. This is cool because it's written by Rodney Stark. He was a research sociologist at Berkeley. He's been published by major publishing houses, 27 books. And he says that Christianity led to the success of Western civilization, to our freedom and our capitalism. And capitalism is freedom. That's all it is.
Yeah, that's right. And this sounds like a really interesting book. In fact, I think I'm going to get it. It's called The Victory of Reason.
The Victory of Reason. And it's so cool to see, here's a secular person again saying, hey, look, Christianity was the foundation from which modern science and capitalism arose. A lot of liberals hate capitalism, but capitalism, another word for it, is freedom. This author has a pretty long definition of capitalism, but my definition is economic freedom, or, as God said it, do not steal. That's it. Do not steal. That's capitalism.
Exactly.
Jesus said, can I not do what I will with my own money? So that's pretty cool.
Well, this next book was by a theistic evolutionist.
And, she's a biologist, Margaret.
Yeah, she's
Towns.
A biologist, and yet she's making claims that have been disproven
forever.
For decades.
This is hysterical.
The reviewer says her training is in biology, so we would expect her to show basic biological knowledge. However, with such comments as vertebrates all contain gill slits and tails as embryos, we know that this has been disproven for literally decades.
This was make-believe. An evolutionist drew make-believe drawings of animals and humans in utero, in the womb.
Yeah, Haeckel, who we mentioned earlier, is the one who did this.
Right.
He called it ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, and he gives it these fancy words, make it sound like it's...
Right, and it's make-believe that human beings go through a fish stage where they have gills and they have tails, and this is not true.
It's not true at all.
And here she is, a trained biologist, writing a book to correct our understanding of the Bible and creation, and she still is deceived by that typical evolutionist lie from decades ago.
And that lie still permeates. It's amazing how that one just won't go away.
Yeah. Fred, at the beginning I said people could get a gift subscription to the Journal of Creation. We have two ways they can get that. If they subscribe to any of our resources at Bob and Yurt Live, our BEL Televised Classics, the old TV shows back on DVD. You saw the
I can't
show.
Wait to get those.
It's fun, right?
Oh, it's awesome.
And the topical videos, the monthly Bible study albums. If anybody subscribes to any of those, we will give you a gift subscription to the Journal of Creation. Or if you order our BEL Science Pack, that's $99.99, so that's a bit expensive. But if you do that, we'll send you this gift subscription. Our phone number, 800-8-NYARDS, 800-836-9278. You can do it online at KGOV, KGOV.com. Fred Williams, thank you.
Thanks again, Bob. It was great to do this.
And Maranatha Christian Center, what a great school. Maranatha.